KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
They don't know what tariffs are going to be in an hour, let alone tomorrow, in a week, in a month, in a year. It's completely uncertain.
President Trump's tariffs are sending stocks sliding. At the same time, there's some good news about the U.S. labor market.
It's Friday, April 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. South Korea's highest court removed its impeached president from office.
The country now has 60 days to elect a new president.
The real problem is going to be much longer lasting, and that's the extreme polarization we have at the moment in South Korean politics.
Later, what theaters are offering to lure moviegoers back.
We just announced our limited time only flavor of Hawaiian Crumble. It's going to be in all AMC theaters. Right in time for Lilo and Stitch.
And college basketball's Final Four is here.
A look at one star player, the University of Connecticut's Paige Beckers.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Internal Revenue Service is cutting more jobs ahead of the April 15th tax filing deadline. NPR's Shannon Bond reports the cuts are part of the Trump administration's directive to slash the size of the federal workforce.
The IRS notified employees by email on Friday that mass reductions are coming across offices and job categories. The goal, it said, is to, quote, increase the efficiency and effectiveness of the IRS. The cuts come during the agency's busiest time of year, with the tax deadline looming, and will roll out in phases. The IRS's Office of Civil Rights and Compliance is the first affected, the email said. The agency is cutting 75% of jobs in that office and says it will transfer remaining staff to another department. The IRS didn't say how many jobs it plans to eliminate in total. It already cut more than 6,000 positions in February. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
President Donald Trump has abruptly fired the head of the National Security Agency. That's according to officials and members of Congress who say 33-year intelligence vet Tim Hawk was let go after Trump met with a conservative activist this week. More from NPR's Greg Myrie.
The White House and the NSA have not commented. However, far-right activist and conspiracy theorist Laura Loomer, who met Trump on Wednesday, praised the dismissals and seemed to take credit. Without providing evidence, Loomer claimed on X that Hawk and Noble were disloyal to President Trump. She described Hawk as a Biden appointee who was, quote, hand-picked by now-retired General Mark Milley. Now, we know there's bad blood between Trump and Milley dating back to Trump's first term.
NPR's Greg Myrie, senior military leaders say they were only informed about the firing of the four-star general yesterday. A federal judge is ordering the Trump administration to return a Maryland man who was deported to El Salvador by mistake. The decision is guaranteed to set up another high-stakes clash between the White House and the courts, appears Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports.
U.S. District Judge Paul Azinis called the deportation of Kilmar Abrego Garcia an illegal act. The man had been living in the U.S. legally and had a work permit when he was arrested and deported last month, despite having been granted deportation protection by an immigration judge in 2019. The Justice Department admits that Abrego Garcia was deported because of an administrative error, but DOJ lawyers argued that he is a member of the criminal gang MS-13 and that the judge lacks the authority to order his return since Abrego Garcia is now in El Salvador. But Judge Zinis did not agree. She ordered the government to return Abrego Garcia to the U.S. by 11:59 p.m. on Monday, April 7th. Sergio Martinez-Beltran, NPR News.
Stocks in the U.S. are in free fall for a second day today as the defiant President Trump continues to push retaliatory tariffs against much of the world. The Dow fell more than 2,200 points. The Nasdaq and the S&P were both down near 6%. This is NPR. Cleanup is underway for parts of Tennessee hit by tornadoes, but more severe weather's in the forecast. As Mariana Bacayao of member station WPLN reports, the storms have already claimed the lives of five people in the state.
Some areas of Tennessee are expected to get up to 8 inches of rain through the weekend, which could lead to flash flooding. Patrick Sheehan, director of the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency, says the flooding could be worse than what hard-hit areas have already experienced this week.
We do expect that much of Tennessee will experience or be near severe weather, and flooding is almost guaranteed to happen or be worsen from what we're experiencing right now.
Damaging winds will be the main concern when storms are strongest Saturday afternoon. The National Guard is stationed across the state and ready for potential rescue missions. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Baca Yao in Nashville.
It's another man-against-machine challenge, but this time it's pitting a professional gambler against an artificial intelligence site in a $1 million wager to be decided by the winner of the Duke-Houston game in the Final Four. Vegas bookies say pro gambler Sean Perry has picked Duke, a 5.5-point favorite. The AI platform, 4C Predictions, is going with Houston. Both professional gambler Perry and the AI platform have done well over the 60 games of the tournament. Perry missed only 13 picks. The AI platform missed only 10. Both picked the Final Four teams correctly. Crude oil futures prices moved lower along with stocks today. Oil down nearly $5 a barrel to $61.99 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach. Now playing in theaters.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump's tariffs are sending shockwaves around the world and striking fear into the stock market. The Dow fell another 2,200 points today. The president's actions have left investors, shoppers, and businesses of all sizes worried about the economy. But we did get a little bit of good news today about the job market. To break down everything that happened in the economy and the markets this week, we're joined by our chief economics correspondent, Scott Horsley, and our financial correspondent, Maria Aspen. Hi to both of you.
Good to be with you.
Hey there.
Maria, I'll start with you. Just how bad are things on Wall Street?
I mean, people are terrified. This is really bad. Yesterday, we saw the U.S. stock market have its worst day in 5 years since the early days of the pandemic, and today was even worse. The stock market has now lost more than $6 trillion in value in 2 days. The Dow more than doubled its loss from yesterday. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 each also fell nearly 6%. And Juana, all of this is a reaction to the trade war getting worse and to the White House seeming determined to stick with it, no matter the potential consequences. Today, we saw China say it would retaliate against President Trump's tariffs. But the president is also slapping really steep taxes on countries that are close allies to the United States, like Japan and the European Union, where officials have also promised to respond. The end result is that U.S. consumers are likely to pay a lot more for almost everything we import.
Well, help us understand for average folks, for consumers, what is the scope of the damage?
This market sell-off affects the majority of Americans. About 60% of U.S. households own stocks, according to the Federal Reserve. And, you know, the market is where people usually have their retirement savings invested through 401ks or other retirement plans. President Trump, who once really cared about how the stock market was doing, seems to be shrugging off this week's crash and what it means for all of his constituents. He posted on Truth Social this morning that my policies will never change and this is a great time to get rich.
Okay. Scott, let's bring you in here. We mentioned that there was also some positive news about the job market. How much comfort can we take from that?
A little bit, but not very much. The Labor Department said today employers added 228,000 jobs in March. That's about twice as many as the month before. That's the good news. But this comes from a survey that was done about 3 weeks ago. So about the best you can say is the job market was looking pretty good before the president lobbed this tariff grenade at the global economy. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell was speaking near Washington today. He acknowledged these tariffs are bigger and broader than most people expected. And Powell says that probably means they're going to push prices higher and slow the economy down more than most people anticipated. But Powell says it's still hard to know how long-lasting the fallout from this trade war might be.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there any chance that President Trump is correct that this could just be short-term pain but would ultimately make the U.S. economy much stronger?
That is certainly the White House argument. I don't think you'll find a lot of mainstream economists who believe that. You know, part of the president's stated goal here is to encourage more domestic manufacturing, and certainly tariffs, along with low taxes and limited regulation, can help to foster that. But another thing factory owners look for is a stable, predictable business environment. And as economist Ernie Tedeschi of the Yale Budget Lab says, nothing about the last few weeks would suggest that's what they'll find in the United States right now.
Because they don't know what tariffs are going to be in an hour, let alone tomorrow, in a week, in a month, in a year. It's completely uncertain.
2 days ago, Trump announced a 46% tariff on imports from Vietnam. Today, he said on social media he looks forward to negotiating with the leader of Vietnam's Communist Party. The president likes to describe himself as the consummate deal maker, but to a lot of people, this looks like a shakedown.
Maria, we'll close with you here. Clearly, there is just a lot of pain for people with stock investments. So tell us, what's the best way to respond right now?
Well, if you can at all help it, don't check your retirement account right now. You're not going to see anything good there.
Nope.
And frankly, there is very little you can or should do about it right now. I talked about this yesterday with Ben Bockham, who's a senior investment strategist at Betterment. He gave me the same advice financial advisors usually have in times of crisis. In short, don't panic.
I think it's important to keep that long-term perspective.
But that's not to underplay the seriousness of this market sell-off or its impact on your personal finances. The underlying truth is that individual investors are pretty powerless right now. There's just not much that can compensate for the chaos that the White House seems determined to cause to the financial markets and potentially to the entire economy.
NPR's Maria Aspen and Scott Horsley, thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
South Korea's highest court has removed the country's president from office just months after parliament voted to impeach him over a brief but shocking declaration of martial law. NPR's Anthony Kuhn has the story from Seoul.
Authorities made it clear that no violence would be tolerated, and some 14,000 police were deployed around the courthouse. But protesters on both sides have been in the streets since last December 3rd, and they were not about to miss this verdict. Both Yoon's opponents and supporters camped out outside the courthouse, and when the verdict was finally announced, anti-Yoon protesters erupted. 21-year-old Kim Shi-un has come to Seoul every weekend to protest. She holds a light stick that fans often wave at K-pop concerts.
I believe we can make a better country, a better South Korea, and live in a better world. That's what kept me coming. And now that we have this result, I'll continue to hold on to hope and come out with my light stick whenever something like this happens again.
Some Yoon supporters reacted angrily to the verdict, but the crowds melted away fairly quickly. The Constitutional Court unanimously ruled that Yoon Song-yeol had violated the Constitution by declaring martial law last December without a valid legal basis. It added that Yoon sending troops to block lawmakers from voting down his decree was also unconstitutional. Yoon had argued that he was just trying to maintain order. But Noh-hee Baum, a lawyer and former Constitutional Court research judge, says that argument doesn't hold water.
For the president to say that he sent armed forces to the National Assembly to maintain order is a false argument. Trying to justify his unconstitutional and unsuccessful self-coup, which he staged to eradicate his political rivals.
South Korea now has 60 days to elect a new president. But Jeffrey Robertson, an associate professor at Yonsei University in Seoul, says this is not the end of the crisis.
The real problem is going to be much longer lasting, and that's the extreme polarization we have at the moment in South Korean politics. So we have individuals on the far left and individuals on the far right who will never see eye to eye.
And that polarization, he argues, sets the stage for more political extremism and democratic backsliding. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
To lure audiences back to the movies, theaters offer more than just popcorn, soda, and candy. Today we get a preview of the newest concessions from NPR's Mandalit Del Barco. She was at a convention for movie theater owners in Las Vegas this week.
At CinemaCon's trade show floor, vendors were showing off a new video game for movie theater lobbies. You try to fill up 50 virtual slushy cups in 42 seconds. Reps for several bowling and billiards companies were also here to pitch to exhibitors. With bowling alleys, arcades, and pickleball courts, more and more movie theaters are entertainment centers. This year's trade show also featured the latest luxury zero-gravity recliners with seats that massage your back. Also the latest laser projectors, robot vacuum cleaners, and concession stand treats, like the new flavors of Dippin' Dots ice cream.
We just announced our limited time only flavor of Hawaiian Crumble. It's going to be in all AMC theaters. Right in time for Lilo and Stitch.
Next to Brian Carney, National Account Manager for Dippin' Dots, was Jason Pope, National Territory Manager of Icy. He showed off a new sweet Icy concoction.
And now we're getting on to the dirty soda trend, which is kind of taking over. And so now we're making dirty Icy. He's putting in some coconut cream to our Minute Maid Lemonade Icy, and then some boba bursting pearls on top of that as well.
With more theaters offering alcohol, the cocktail company Bartesian demonstrated its premium single-serve on-demand drink-making machine.
Who wants a Mai Tai?
Who wants a Mai Tai?
Anybody?
Of course, there's popcorn. Andrew Kreeders runs the company Kreeders with his siblings, supplying popcorn machines to theaters in more than 150 countries.
The company was started in the Chicago area by my great-great-grandfather. He patented the first modern-day popcorn machine in 1893.
He was in Las Vegas showing off their new energy-efficient induction popcorn poppers. But the latest popcorn trend is collectible movie-themed buckets. The Australian company Zinc showed off its containers shaped like R2-D2 from Star Wars, the skull from Alien, and the sandworm from last year's Dune Part 2, which went viral.
When this came out, the Dune bucket, it just opened the floodgates.
Rod Mason is Zinc's Vice President of Business Development. He says, like movie theaters, his business took a hit during the COVID-19 pandemic and again when films were delayed by the Hollywood writers and actors strikes. Mason says fun concessions are just one way to get audiences used to streaming movies back into theaters. But it all comes down to content.
No matter how many great popcorn containers and drink containers we do, if the movie doesn't perform, you know, it's disappointing for the cinema owners.
Mason says he's looking forward to a box office boost this summer. Among Zinc's upcoming collectible cups are some topped with a mini race car helmet, like the one worn by Brad Pitt in the upcoming movie F1. They'll be in theaters in June. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Las Vegas.
The chocolate bars and the candy, so let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court sided with the Trump administration, at least for now, in a dispute with the Department of Education over what it considers DEI-related grants. The vote was 5-4, with Chief Justice Roberts and the court's three liberals dissenting. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is here to explain. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Ari.
What exactly was at issue here?
Well, this case involves the Education Department's decision to block distribution of $65 million in grant funding that had already been appropriated by Congress. And the funding went to two programs within the Department of Education targeting teacher shortages. They provided teacher training and professional development for aspiring educators, and the grants were targeted at high-need institutions, historically Black colleges, and universities and tribally controlled colleges and universities. The department also sent letters to the recipients of these grants, stating that their programs violated federal civil rights laws by discriminating based on race, sex, or other protected characteristics. Now, there are eight states whose universities and nonprofits had their grants terminated, and they challenged what the administration did in court. They argued that the administration exceeded its power by eliminating grant programs that Congress had set up. And a federal judge issued what we've heard a lot of, temporary restraining orders, two of them consecutively, that amounted to 28 days in which the administration was barred from eliminating the program while he considered the case. Now, these orders, these TROs, they're generally not considered appealable because they last such a short time. But today, the Supreme Court, while acknowledging that this is the normal practice, at the same time seemed to rewrite the rule book on that.
And it was a 5-4 ruling. Tell us more about how the votes broke down.
Well, the five were Justices Thomas and Alito and the three Trump appointees to the court. Barrett, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and have I left anybody off?
No, that's the five, yeah.
That's the five. In dissent, Chief Justice Roberts said he would have simply refused to grant the stay. He didn't say anything more. But the court's liberals, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson, they had quite a bit to say. They noted that not only was the temporary restraining order about to expire anyway in 3 days, but that the court majority, in Kagan's words, was making a serious mistake by making significant changes to the court's existing law with only bare bones briefing, no oral argument, and scarce time for reflection. Those are her words.
This is just the start of what could be a flood of cases involving the Trump administration likely to come before the Supreme Court. What are the big ones that you're looking at? So many.
Yes, so many. The government has also asked the court to block lower court actions in legal disputes impeding its agenda across the board. Some of them involve the one judge's order to reinstate 16,000 employees who were fired. Another court stopped the administration from denying birthright citizenship for some children born in the United States. Another is that what I call colloquially, it's been a long day, folks. The airplanes case, the judge who said you can't
the
just
deportations
deport,
to
can't,
El Salvador.
You can't just yeah. deport people and not have a hearing first, and you've got to bring them back. And that's up in front of the court, too.
And many more to come. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thanks for your reporting, as always.
Thanks, Ari.
It's Final Four weekend for college basketball. One of the best players on the floor tonight, Paige Beckers. She's played for the University of Connecticut since 2020 and has accomplished pretty much everything except a championship. The Huskies face top-ranked UCLA in the semis, hoping to advance to Sunday's title game. Steve Futterman reports.
She is without doubt one of the biggest names in women's basketball. At 6 feet, Paige Beckers, with her trademark braids and ponytail flipping back and forth, is a recognizable figure at every UConn game, often weaving her way down the court before suddenly stopping and shooting.
Here comes Beckers, Connecticut with numbers. Beckers pull up. He's good! Paige Beckers taking over!
This season, the 23-year-old guard is connecting on nearly 54% of her shots, among the best in the nation. Her fame is international. Aya Vaksani is here in Tampa this week to watch the Final Four. She grew up in Latvia, where she played basketball. She now lives in Madrid. In Spain, are followers of women's basketball, are they aware of her?
Oh, yes, very much so. I think she's really talented. I mean, she's very versatile. She can go right, she can shoot. Her height is amazing. I mean, she's pretty much a full package.
By the age of 14, Beckers was already on the radar of college coaches. When she graduated high school in Minnesota, she was the number one recruit in the country. She came to UConn with enormously high expectations, and in her freshman year, she exceeded them, averaging 20 points a game. She led UConn to the Final Four before losing to Arizona and won all sorts of postseason awards.
And the ESPY goes to Paige Beckers.
At the ESPN ESPY Awards, Beckers won for Best Female Athlete in all of college sports and gave a memorable speech, paying tribute to black players who she said historically never received proper acclaim.
As a white woman who leads a black-led sport, and celebrated here, I want to show a light on black women. They don't get the media coverage that they deserve.
In 2022 came a major challenge. Beckers tore her ACL, forcing her to skip a year. But last season, she came back hardly missing a beat. Again, she led UConn to the Final Four before losing to Iowa and Caitlin Clark, who she has known and played with and against since they were in middle school. After last season, Beckers was eligible to enter the WNBA draft. Would she leave or stay? Beckers announced her decision at a UConn game.
I know everybody wants me to address the elephant in the room. Unfortunately, this will not be my last senior night here at UConn.
That set the stage for this season. Her success has brought financial rewards. With college players now able to monetize their name, image, and likeness, Beckers this year is estimated to be earning around $1.4 million. Now comes her final chance to win that championship. UConn, with its rich history, has won a record 11 women's titles, but none since 2016. Beckers wants to win number 12.
Anything less than a national championship is really a disappointment. As players, that's what you play for and what you want to live up to.
After this weekend here in West Florida, Paige Beckers' college career will be over, but there won't be much time to rest. She's expected to be the top pick in the WNBA draft on April 14th and then make her professional debut in May. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Tampa.
This is NPR News.
Lucy Caldwell's grandmother never talked about the Belfast Blitz when Germany bombed the city in World War II.
Anytime I asked her, she would always say, "Oh, sure, what do you want to know about that for? There's no good can come of talking of it."
Her curiosity is now a novel, These Days. Plus the latest political and economic news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The defense secretary wants transgender troops out of the military.
Judges have blocked that move.
And so many of the service members themselves are in limbo.
It's incredibly disheartening to be told that no matter how good you were, none of it matters. You have to get out. We don't want you here.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Stocks sank for a second day as investors recoiled from President Trump's widening trade war. Estimates are upwards of $6 trillion in wealth has evaporated almost overnight. NPR Scott Horsley tells us the Dow tumbled more than 2,200 points today and is down nearly 8% for the week.
Fallout from the far-reaching tariff plan that Trump announced 2 days ago continues to pummel financial markets. China promised to retaliate with steep tariffs of its own on U.S. exports. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell acknowledged Trump's import taxes are higher than most people expected. As a result, Powell says they'll likely push prices up and slow the economy down more than many people anticipated. There was some positive economic news. The Labor Department reports that U.S. employers added 228,000 jobs last month, more than twice as many as the month before. That count is a little stale, though, since it was taken 3 weeks ago before this week's tariff turmoil. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has announced plans to hold its first lease sale to auction offshore drilling rights off the Gulf Coast. NPR's Jeff Brady reports this comes as oil prices have fallen because traders fear the president's tariffs will slow economic growth and oil demand.
President Trump campaigned on more drilling for fossil fuels, even though production already is at record highs. About 15% of the country's oil and gas production comes from the Gulf of Mexico, which Trump renamed the Gulf of America. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum said on Fox News the sale will bring money from oil companies into the federal treasury.
When they bid on that lease, they pay the federal government money, and then when they develop those minerals, they pay a royalty. All of that goes towards helping reducing our debt and reducing our deficit.
The Interior Department says it expects to publish a lease sale notice in June.
This is NPR. Florida lawmakers are debating reducing their child labor protections this spring, joining several other states that have already done it. From member station WFSU, Tristan Wood reports.
Florida's considering allowing 16-year-olds to work more than the current 30-hour-a-week cap, and loosening some limits on 14-year-olds if they're in homeschool, virtual education, or already graduated. Nina Mast, a policy analyst at the Washington-based Economic Policy Institute, says the rollbacks nationally are being championed by business industry groups looking to drive down wages that went up in lower-paying industries during the pandemic.
This is really a concerted nationwide effort to essentially create a permanent underclass of disempowered low-wage workers.
Supporters of the bill say it gives minor employment choices to parents and gives teens experiences they need as adults. For NPR News, I'm Tristan Wood in Tallahassee.
Los Angeles County has reached a tentative $4 billion settlement over more than 6,800 juvenile sexual abuse claims dating back to 1959. A majority of the cases happened at probation department facilities and at the McLaren Children's Center. A statement from L.A. County calls this the costliest financial settlement in its history. At least two of the cases have been referred to the DA's office for possible prosecution. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Today, President Trump announced he'll be extending a deadline to ban TikTok. And if this sounds familiar, well, it's the second time the Chinese social media app has evaded a ban. It now has another 75 days to find an American buyer. TikTok's had a wild couple months, and NPR tech correspondent Bobby Allen is here to bring us up to speed. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Ari.
Another day, another delay on the TikTok ban. Were you expecting this?
I mean, Ari, I really wasn't. I spoke to someone directly involved in these discussions yesterday, and this person said an announcement about a big TikTok deal from the White House seemed to be ready to go. Then this morning came around, everyone's waiting. Is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And nothing happened. Behind the scenes, though, you know, things were quite chaotic. Among the factors that really put a stick in the spoke of this plan was President Trump's firing recently of several National Security Council staffers. Mm-hmm. And one of them was running the TikTok deal. Another factor that likely complicated this, those stiff tariffs that Trump imposed on many countries, including China.
We have more on those national security firings in another part of the show. But how did we even get to this place to begin with?
Yeah, 5 years ago in the pandemic, when TikTok, you know, was really surging in popularity, concerns about its China connections really started to grow. And back then, in Trump's first term, he tried to ban the app, and lawmakers of both parties got behind him. But now, in his second term, he supports TikTok. He's credited the app with helping to drive young voters to the polls. But when he got in office, he had to confront a law Congress passed requiring TikTok to be spun off from ByteDance, its Beijing owner, or be banned. But the start date of that law, as you mentioned, has now been paused twice. And in the meantime, there's just been a flurry of bidders, from YouTuber Mr. Beast to Amazon to the adult content site OnlyFans. We're even hearing that Walmart is interested, all sorts of suitors trying to come after TikTok. And Trump has been encouraging these bids.
Do you know if there's one particular bid the White House is leaning towards?
Yeah, there is. And it looks something like this. Negotiators say a new entity with a consortium of U.S. companies and investors will likely be created. It's being called TikTok America, and it would involve many companies, including Oracle. And the plan is to license TikTok's algorithm from ByteDance, and then all of Americans' data and how the algorithm is used would be audited and monitored by this group. ByteDance would keep a minority stake in the company, but basically operate what's essentially a U.S. subsidiary with just some extra national security controls in place. So that is the idea, Ari, as of now. But with, you know, like so much else in the Trump White House, this situation is just very much in flux.
I think a lot of TikTok users remember that 14-hour blink out. Is something like that going to happen again, or will service continue uninterrupted?
I don't think we're going to see another blackout, but again, this has been a wild ride. We just don't know what's going to happen. Not expecting any disruptions in any regard, but again, this has just been a really unpredictable tale for TikTok. So I think TikTokers can keep doing their thing. We shall see. Legally, though, Ari, it's really a quite different situation. I mean, under this law that Congress passed, TikTok is right now operating illegally. But the Trump administration says, through Trump's Department of Justice, it will not be enforcing the law. So it is a law on the books with no teeth. We shall see, Ari, in 75 days if there is any more certainty, especially legally, for TikTok.
NPR's Bobby Allen, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Ari.
Transgender troops are in limbo. A Department of Defense initiative would make it difficult for most of them to remain in the military, although multiple federal judges have blocked enforcement of the policy. Steve Walsh with WHRO in Norfolk reports this has left troops with a difficult choice.
Joe Ellis understands more than most how charged the moment has become for transgender service members. A Black Hawk pilot, Ellis was falsely accused of causing the DC crash between an airliner and a military helicopter in January.
It was really interesting to see the hate come my way. Even though I know it exists, it wasn't a surprise. It's kind of the reality of being someone who's open about being trans, but it was just a lot to have focus towards me.
Alice grew up in Norfolk. She transitioned 18 months ago as a member of the Virginia National Guard. She posted about the experience a few days before the crash.
What's interesting is me as a target, it didn't really fit their narrative at all because I grew up in a conservative house. I voted red more than blue in my entire voting record. I've served the military for 15 years. I'm a veteran, combat veteran.
Ellis says her guard unit has supported her through her transition and the negative publicity.
I know these people so well. My entire Army career, I've been with these people, and we've all kind of risen up through the ranks together. So it really is a family, and it's hard to feel like you're being kicked out of your family.
The Department of Defense issued a memo in February targeting transgender service members. So far, three lawsuits challenging the policies are in the pipeline. A judge's order is blocking the policy from taking effect. Still, Ellis, like all other transgender troops, faces a choice.
I have no intentions of surrendering and leaving. I want to stay and be in as long as they'll let me. I'm in a very fortunate position where I'm not active duty. I'm not tied to my guard employment for my livelihood, so I can actually wait it out.
Elyria Stanley is a 20-year Army veteran who is now with the Transgender American Veterans Association. She came out publicly as transgender during the Obama administration in 2016, when it became legal to serve openly. She held on through Trump 1 when recruiting was stopped, but troops already serving could stay, at least through their enlistment. Under Biden, she became one of the first openly transgender troops to retire with full benefits. The Pentagon has been offering incentives to trans people to leave voluntarily. Stanley says she understands the mindset of some who have already taken the separation package and left, even with the court challenges still underway.
Combat service doesn't matter. I do my job. Look at all these decorations and awards and promotions. Doesn't matter. It's incredibly disheartening to be told that no matter how good you were, none of it matters. You have to get out. We don't want you here.
A RAND study found transgender troops serving openly had little impact on the readiness of a unit or a person's ability to serve. Not everyone who is transgender experiences gender dysphoria, but Stanley worries that fears of being diagnosed with the condition will make troops even more reluctant to seek mental health care.
If you say something, it gets entered into your record, and so you might risk losing it all. It's not just your career, but if you have dependents, you lose their health care, you lose their educational benefits, you lose housing, everything.
On social media, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth has declared that the Pentagon will continue to fight to implement the policy, one that advocates believe would drive most transgender troops out of the military. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy npr.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Ever get frustrated by how many emails you get from stores and brands? Well, so has Sarah Gonzalez with our Planet Money podcast.
Can I just vent to you for a little bit?
Yes.
Cynthia Price is an email marketing expert at a company called Litmus. Okay, so I get an email a day from, it seems like, every store I have ever interacted with ever, in any way, shape, or form. And I don't know why, like, who buys things from an email that they get?
A lot of people.
Yeah. Of all the forms of marketing, somehow email has one of the highest returns on investment. Cynthia says, let's say you're a store with 100,000 people on your email list, and you send out an email that's like, spring deals are in bloom. Just like 3% of those people are actually going to click through to your store's website to see any of your spring deals.
That's not to mention the people that are going to buy from it.
Yeah, even fewer are actually going to buy something. So not that many people bite, but some do. And that's apparently worth it. For every $1 spent on email marketing, there is a $42 to $48 return on investment for the store. That's the average.
Yep.
That's a real stat?
It's a real stat.
A 4,000% return on investment?
Yeah, it is incredibly effective.
Part of that is just that email is cheap, right? You're paying for someone to write an email, maybe make it pretty. But the bigger thing is, you invited these stores into your inbox.
You have actually raised your hand and said, yeah, send me promotional emails in some way, shape, or form.
You probably bought something from them. So it's just more likely that you will buy something again.
Which just is like an entirely different world to play in as a marketer than it would be if I was trying to target everyone on Instagram who is between the ages of 20 and 25.
It's expensive to get your ad in front of people online. And sure, Instagram marketing is also relentless, and it feels like all social media just knows everything about our wants and likes and buying patterns. But Cynthia says, email marketing, they actually know we want their content. But do we though? Cynthia acknowledges that inundating us with email, like many stores do, can backfire.
You're going to unsubscribe because you're so annoyed by it, or you will completely learn to just completely tune them out and you won't even look at what the subject line says at all. You probably are already there.
Oh, I'm there. And unsubscribing is kind of like the biggest fail in marketing land. Like, you had me and you blew it. You lost me. But some stores don't really care if they damage their reputation with us. We have to wake up every single morning to 30 marketing emails just because someone else out there is gonna buy something. And Cynthia says some brands do hit a sweet spot. Like, there's a snowboarding gear company that sends out emails whenever there's fresh snow on the mountains, targeted to your location, like the closest mountain to you with fresh snow. That seems useful. And Cynthia says she actually enjoys getting store emails.
I think it's around 60% of people say that email is their preferred way to communicate with brands.
I mean, as opposed to like a phone call from a store, then yes, sure. I would prefer an email
like
to a phone call.
A banner ad or a text message.
Yes, I also don't want text messages. Point is, getting an email a day from a store, probably here to stay. Sarah Gonzalez, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Universities in Europe are offering academic refuge to researchers in the U.S. who've lost jobs or who feel their academic freedom is under attack as the Trump administration cuts funding to colleges and universities. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports.
One of the European programs promises protection from, quote, political interference or censorship. Another, at Aix-en-Marseille University in the south of France, is called a safe place for science.
C'est un programme qui consiste à offrir un asile scientifique à des collègues américains.
It's a program which offers scientific asylum for our colleagues, says Eric Berton, the president of Aix-en-Marseille. It's a reaction by us to preserve academic freedom.
On a voulu monter ce programme en réaction pour préserver la liberté académique.
Berton says they have had over 200 eligible applications for the funds that can support about 15 researchers. These include biologists, epidemiologists, and climate scientists from top American universities, including Yale, Columbia, and Stanford. Since Donald Trump took office in January, his administration has taken aim at federal funding, which has also affected researchers and universities. In part, it's over DEI policies.
We've ended the tyranny of so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion policies.
The administration has also engaged in mass firings at federal agencies, including at scientific research institutes, and cancelled billions of dollars in grants as part of broad cost-cutting measures. And it's targeted studies on climate change and other major areas of research that the administration sometimes calls woke.
And our country will be woke no longer.
In online discussion boards for academics, many now discuss plans to leave the country. Researchers feel targeted and so insecure that of the 10 academics I reached out to for this story, none would speak on the record. With visas and green cards being revoked for expressing opinions and stating facts, one European professor in the US replied to me, I don't want to expose myself or my family publicly. I spoke with one affected assistant professor who asked to remain anonymous because she didn't want her employer to know that she's applying to move abroad. She said she simply doesn't feel free to do her research or teach any longer in the US. Jan Dunkat is the Vice Chancellor of the Free University of Brussels.
It's important that some of these research lines are indeed continued.
European universities want to attract scientific talent, but Dunkat says there's also a genuine wish to show solidarity.
What we see in the United States is indeed an interference of government, and this is worrying.
Rob Quinn is the Executive Director of the Scholars at Risk Network, a nonprofit that works in countries around the world.
To protect threatened scholars and intellectuals, usually from violence or extreme coercive pressure, prosecution, imprisonment, harassment.
The more extreme aspects of this work is often in war zones like in Ukraine or in places with repressive governments like China. But now, he says, pressures are mounting in the US.
We would say this in any country around the world. If it is the state that tells the university what questions it can ask, what dialogues it can have, what people it is allowed to admit for study, what people it is allowed to hire to do teaching. If the state is telling all of that, then you no longer have a free society and you no longer have free universities.
Whatever happens in the US, European universities now see both an opportunity and a duty to open their doors. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Paris is undergoing a major transformation. In a referendum last month, 66% of Parisians voted to convert 500 more streets into pedestrian zones, marking one of the biggest shifts in how the city moves. It's the latest step in the mayor's years-long effort to make Paris greener, quieter, and less car-dependent. But as NPR's Rebecca Rossman discovered, not everyone is thrilled about the changes.
8 years ago, Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo made a bold promise to make cars vanish. She vowed to cut vehicle circulation in half, less smog, more bike lanes, and more footpaths. Like this one in the city's 18th district, just behind the Sacre Coeur. That's where I meet 39-year-old Pierre Caban. He's set up a table and chairs where cars used to park. and enjoys a leisurely lunch in the sun with friends. No surprise, then, when Caban tells me he voted in favor of the plan to pedestrianize 500 more Paris streets.
Just the less cars you have, I think the more pleasant it is for people to live in.
But not everyone is on board. Some Parisians say these changes come at a cost. Reda Casera has been a Paris taxi driver for 25 years. I meet him on Rue de Rivoli, a major street that now dedicates most of its space to bikes, leaving just a single lane for taxis, buses, and emergency vehicles.
La circulation devient insupportable.
Traffic, he says, has become unbearable, and that means fewer people are taking taxis.
On favorise les Parisiens, mais on méprise les citoyens français qui viennent travailler.
Speaking of the referendum, he says it may be great for Parisians, but it shows nothing but scorn for the people who come to work here, and that a taxi ride that used to take 15 minutes can now take an hour. Carlos Moreno, an urban planner and advisor to Mayor Hidalgo, says pedestrianization isn't just about traffic. It's about rethinking urban life.
This is the sense of this new urban policy. Walkability, bikeability, green areas, public spaces, local shops, local economy, social interactions.
He says Paris learned from cities like Amsterdam. Before its cycling revolution in the 1970s, road deaths across the Netherlands had reached record highs, some 3,000 in 1971 alone. That crisis helped turn the Dutch capital into one of the most bike-friendly cities in the world.
I said to my friends in Los Angeles, maybe you will be the next to Amsterdam if you will decide to start this transformation. Even if we need to be patient and to take time for that. But the most important is to start.
Mayor Anne Hidalgo won't be running for re-election, but her vision is reshaping Paris in ways that will long outlast her time in office. The city's major boulevards are quieter than ever. A lot of the noise pollution today comes from construction sites like this one, yet another street, this one in the Marais, being dug up and turned into a car-free walking zone. A sign that Paris isn't just cutting cars, it's making the city of lights into the city of bikes. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John...
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet. Ain't no hope.